So it is June 1st, 2006. I'm David Brooks, and I'm the interviewer for the University of Montana's Oral History Project. And today I'm talking with Dean Larry Gianchetta about your time here at the university. And so would you start us off possibly by talking a little about your personal and educational background that led you to UM?
Okay. All right. I am a native of Idaho. Did my undergraduate work in business at Idaho State University. Went on for a master's at the University of Montana in mathematical statistics. It was during that time in Wyoming that I taught and realized that it was something I had a passion for. And so towards the end of my completion of my master's degree at Laramie, I sent out in the Northwest to state universities a form letter, actually, indicating my interest of coming and teaching for a year or two on the faculty to determine whether I wanted to go on to get a PhD. The chair of the Department of Management called me and started by saying, Larry, this looks like a form letter. And I says, well, that's because it is. And he says, what are you up to? So I explained to him basically what I was up to. And he called a few references and hired me actually over the phone. So in 1969, I came to the University of Montana with a master's degree as an instructor. After 2 years, my passion for teaching only grew. The other thing I was trying to measure is the dynamics of faculty politics. And my sense was that I could cope with that as well. So I went on to Texas A&M University, got a PhD in mathematical statistics, which I tell everybody prepared me perfectly to be a business school dean. I'm saying that in jest to some extent, obviously. I never imagined myself as a role of a business school dean at that time in my life. Quite honestly, this university followed my progress at Texas A&M very, very closely because they were interested, as I was, in us reuniting here at the University of Montana. So I came actually back in January of 75 as an assistant professor.
So, you know, you left for a few years to do your PhD, and the two things you've mentioned as attracting you back here were your passion for teaching and that you could cope with the faculty politics, I think is how you put it. So talk a little bit about when you got here, what relationships were like between you and other faculty in general, on the campus, and relationships between teachers and students.
Yeah. Well, you know, as a adjunct faculty member, as an instructor, I think, you know, tenure and tenure track faculty, we're not significant in the scheme of things, but it still gave me an opportunity to kind of observe what went on. And probably the first experience I remember is we had a faculty member on the faculty who was tenured, who had written a book in basic statistics, and of course one of the courses I taught was Introduction to Statistics. I reviewed his book and decided it wasn't appropriate for the introductory level, so I created a little bit of a stir in my early years. They usually try not to pay attention to instructors, even in the faculty meetings. But, you know, when you have a new instructor who's decided that there are other basic statistics books that would be better for the students than one written by a current faculty member, that created a little bit of an issue. And I survived that, so maybe that was the supreme test. I was well received. I think what you can say about the University of Montana is there's a real love for the student and a real love for teaching generally across the campus. And I think if you have that same passion and you're pretty effective in the classroom, I think that really carries a long way here with the faculty.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a minute about students at the time. You know, it's 1969, you came here first, but when you came back with your PhD, mm-hmm. it would have been what year?
January of 75.
So The university has grown quite a bit after mm-hmm. World War II mm-hmm. at that point. Mm-hmm. You're in the midst or tail end of sort of Vietnam, which mm-hmm. seems in a lot of people's opinion to be a sort of volatile time on right. this campus as well as others, but perhaps things are settling down by then. What sort of things were you involved in with students besides just the classroom? And talk a little bit about your involvement, what the feel was, concerns of students were at the time.
Well, actually, in 69, it was sort of the height of the Vietnam War and issues about the war. I met and got to know President Bob Panzer quite well. And, you know, we always talk about the right leader at the right time. And I really feel this university was very fortunate to have Bob Panzer in the president's office at that time, because I think given all the difficulties and all the concerns and all the student unrest over, you know, the war, I think he dealt with it in a very open door way. He had a lot of open forums in the Oval. I mean, it was very difficult. When I came back in 75, maybe because I was sort of at the height of the activity in 69, certainly there was, you know, it wasn't this high profile issues about the war during that time. Students seemed to be pretty focused again on academics and adding value to themselves intellectually. And so I would say when I returned, you know, there was much more focus on the basic mission that everybody was here for, and that was to learn and to teach.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I suppose in 75, certainly in 69, you know, when I think about you saying you sent out a form letter and just introduced yourself and got hired that way, that seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that something, a time that has perhaps passed, that sort of congeniality, and maybe things were small enough at the time that could happen and maybe couldn't today. And the other thing is, before we started talking here, you had told me that you were one-time coach of the tennis team mm-hmm, here mm-hmm, as well. Mm-hmm. And that also seems to have passed from what I can observe, a person being able to teach and coach at the same time.
Right, right. Okay. You know, I don't know. Again, I think at the instructor level, if you had the right references and you had the right credentials and you really were coming here for a year or two to be an instructor, you know, one of the things I think a lot of us look at for instructorships is an opportunity for students who might be interested long-term of a career in higher education to experiment a little bit and then go on with a PhD. You know, there are certainly issues with security and background checks and those kinds of things, David, that certainly I think there'd been a lot more formality in the process. I don't think in a 24-hour period I would have received a phone call and the query about the form letter, and after having called a couple of references, calling back and saying, you have the job if you want it, you know. And so there are a lot of things that are different in terms of background checks and security issues. The tennis team is an interesting thing. I know that you're in history and interested in history, and of course we all remember Bob Lindsay with a lot of affection. And he is a faculty member one time, also coached the tennis team. And I actually played tennis in high school and played a little bit of Junior Davis Cup tennis. When I came here, I entered in the intramural tennis tournament. I was a little more nimble then and had quite good success. And a few weeks after the second time I entered the tournament, Harley Lewis, he was the athletic director at the time, one day said, well, geez, you should come over and be the tennis coach. And I said, oh yeah, Harley, that's great. I'll do that someday. And really never thought anything more about it. And then he called me a couple of months later and said, Larry, have you made your mind up? And I said, made your mind up about what? And he said, we'd really like to consider you being the tennis coach. So I visited with Bob a little bit, Bob Lindsay, about how it worked for him and how he could make it work. And based on that conversation and Harley's urging and you know, my interest in the game, I actually, for 5 years, starting in 1980, was the men's tennis coach. If you're trying to put this in historical perspective, I knew about Chris Nord. I'm the Nord family. I've known his dad, Ron, and Phyllis, his mother, who has since passed away. Chris was at Boise State. In fact, when I was coaching the men here, we played against Chris in the conference, and of course. I knew from the team's point of view, it wasn't in the best interest, because my primary goal here was to develop as a faculty member, of course. I actually always had Chris in mind, and Chris kind of knew that. Chris came right after he graduated, and believe it or not, he's now been tennis coach for 21 years, which is hard for me to imagine. I go over still when they have home matches and still visit with Chris fairly frequently. And I think the university is really fortunate to have Chris Nord in that position.
So tell me a little about the physical changes in the School of Business, as well as I suppose you could comment on the athletics during your time here. You know, we're sitting in a building that's fairly new right now.
Right.
And so you
right.
certainly weren't in this building when you got here.
No, I was not, and we were not. You know, and people still call refer to it as a new building, and relatively, David, using your term, it is still relatively new, but this is our 10th anniversary in this building. It's a little over five times larger than the building we were in previous to this. The School of Education occupies that building now, and this has been a wonderful facility for the School of Business. Before, we actually had about half of our faculty in what is now the School of Education building, and then we had some faculty in the little white houses on Eddy Street. We had some faculty over in Corbin Hall. We still today are the largest academic unit on campus. When you think about single units, obviously the College of Arts and Sciences, with all of its units, is bigger than the business school. But for a single academic unit, we're the largest single academic unit on campus. And so the goal was to get, you know, us all under one roof, because it doesn't serve the students very well when they don't know where in the university neighborhood they might find one of the business school faculty, because we were literally spread all over. As we built the building, we were able to approach alums of the university that resided in Hewlett-Packard and Microsoft, and not only did they help us equip the building at the time, but David, literally about every 2 years, we've replaced all the equipment in this building, in every office, in every lab, and in every classroom, because of alums who value the education they gained while they were here. The other thing that I don't think people know, certainly people from history know it, Harry Fritz was over teaching again here this year, is this is really the Gallagher Business Building, even though it's called the Gallagher Business Building, has really created what we know on every campus as sort of the campus classroom building. Half of the classes that are taught in the Gallagher Business Building are by non-business faculty. They're faculty in music, in history, in biology, in journalism. And they and their students all really benefit from the technology, the state-of-the-art technology that's here. And we have a wonderful director of technology, and he has a very strong staff. So literally, when faculty from history or other academic units come here, our technology staff kind of work with them. And an area like history actually comes much more exciting with the right technology to drive it. And so I would have to say, initially, when we were even thinking about the building and building the building, and I was pretty public that this would be a building that would serve not only the campus community, but the broader community. You know, the faculty and staff realized that there'd be issues relative to that. You know, I basically have a full-time staff person here in the business school that all she does is schedule this building. This building is a 24/7 center for the university and the Missoula community. It's you know, whether it's a Missoula Symphony coming in here or whatever. I mean, this building literally is utilized very heavily by both the university community and the broader Missoula community. It really has served a wonderful purpose. And so we walk in here every morning. I walk in here every morning, and the first thing I do is turn to the right, look at the Wall of Honor, and look at Bill and Rosemary Gallagher. I got to know Bill and Rosemary very, very well. We actually had the memorial service for Bill Gallagher when we were halfway completed with the building. And Denny Washington, he would argue that Bill Gallagher is the person who gave Denny his start. And he worked for Bill for quite a while, and then Denny, Bill told Denny, I think you're ready to take some of this equipment here and go out and do this thing for yourself. But Bill and Rosemary Gallagher had the Caterpillar dealership for 43 years in Montana, in Wyoming, and part of Idaho. He was a 1925 graduate of the business school, and he always remembered that. And while I was here, I never let him forget it. But what generous people. I mean, generous, you know, in this building, but just general to the whole Missoula community. And I still reside on I'm one of three trustees that oversee the Gallagher Foundation. And their legacy lives on in terms of people in the community who send in proposals, and we continue to, you know, give support to those kinds of initiatives at Bill and Rosemary. But I literally, every morning when I walk in, the first thing I do is look up their picture, and see the twinkle in Bill's eye, and see the smile on Rosemary's face. And after 10 years, David, we still, and I think the faculty and staff would tell you this, we still do not take for granted how blessed we are with this. Mm-hmm. It represents really what's happened on the entire campus, though. Academic buildings that have come up. Panzer Hall, Bob Panzer and I used to talk affectionately about the Gallagher building and Panzer Hall, because a very similar comment was made when they were both erected, and that was, geez, these buildings look like they've been here forever. And I know in the design of both those buildings, there was a lot of concern to respect the integrity of the history and tradition of the building. So if you look at the Gallagher building, you'll actually see the diamonds that, if you look across the street from where we are, exist in Brantley Hall, the same diamonds. And so what we did is we built brand new buildings that looked like they had been there for quite a while. And quite frankly, that was the highest compliment that Bob and I ever felt that we ever received, is people would comment about the buildings in that way. Athletic facilities. I mean, what we have. I mean, I love reading Sports Illustrated and reading that bar none in 1AA football, there's only one place in the world to go and watch a football game, and that in large part is due to the fantastic facility that's been built. That had dramatic issues on this campus because, you know, state institutions will always operate on limited resources. And you and I know that there's always a tug between academic and athletics. Now, you and I are also two people who believe in sound mind and sound body, right, David? Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a lot of synergy, obviously, between academics and athletics. But it's great to see a lot of the faculty who, at the time that stadium was being built, having a lot of concern about priorities, and I think they were legitimate concerns. Being over there, and I noticed that they're among the most obnoxious in the fan base, you know, when a game's going on. And the real point is, I think they've grown to appreciate the added value of the athletic facilities to the campus. So we're really blessed. We're really blessed with the physical facilities. At the end of the day, though, it's about the people, you know, and And so it's great to have the facilities that we have. And I think what it does do is it attracts a higher level of faculty. I know at the business school, we've been able to recruit in the last 10 years faculty with national and international reputations. Mm-hmm. And a lot of why they came here is why I sought this place out and stayed here is a wonderful culture on this campus. I love the liberal arts space. I think it serves our business students really, really well. I'm the first to tell everybody I run into. In fact, I just talked to a person in San Francisco this morning on the phone and was trying to share about the University of Montana. And a statistic that they all relate to is we're still, among all public universities, fifth in the nation in terms of the number of Rhodes Scholars. And I really think that talks about the fabric and the culture that exists on this campus. It's so critical. I think people are surprised when I tell them, there are some academic majors on this campus where 90 out of 120 credits happen within their academic home. Our accrediting body, and we are strong believers, that more than half of the credits that our students take are outside of the School of Business. Because that's what really will make you a successful business person, is to have that broader education. The buildings are wonderful, but what remains the same here is the culture that attracted me here 32 years ago. Mm-hmm. That's really the importance of it. I really believe that has remained pretty much unchanged. Mm-hmm. And still a culture that I'm very, very proud of.
So you've laid out pretty well the connections that this building and the School of Business have with the broader Missoula and Montana community. Mm-hmm. In terms of alumni donations, the founders of this building. Right. But you also mentioned that the building serves the community, and I think mm-hmm. the one example I heard you give was the Missoula Symphony coming right. here. How about some other examples of what this building hosts for the community?
Well, I'll be real candid with you, David. We've had to kind of be a little more conservative over time. At first, we made a real effort to sort of receive everybody into the building. So for a couple of years, Loyola High School had their prom here in the piazza on the second level, which was a wonderful place for a school of that size to have their prom. And it came about really because we had parents of sons and daughters who were going to Loyola High School, Region 1 Forest Service, since the year we've opened, comes every spring break and have about 700. Region 1 is a wide region in the Northwest. Foresters come here for a week-long educational program. It's a wide range of things that we serve, but the Missoula Symphony comes here and has musical programs over here in the music building, and then we have really nice spaces in here for receptions and those sorts of things. So debate teams, we all know about Loyola's long tradition of, you can tell we have a lot of parents who have sons and daughters over at Loyola. Matt Sturgis, and his string of state championships. We actually host, this building fills up entirely, and I think that's BC, I'm trying to remember what class that is in high schools. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful opportunity for us to show off the building and have prospective students think about maybe coming to the business school at the university. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you, I get a little nervous. When Rosemary was alive and we were doing some of this, one of her common complaints was, and I know I'm saying this and it'll be heard, but Larry, don't you think they're wearing the building out? Because we really did open it to everything. The one thing, Rosemary, of course, was here for the first half of this building's life, and every February 14th, she would be the sweetheart of the business school, and would bring her and would put her right at the wall of honor. And I'd always like to bring her at one point of her visit where the classes would change. because it'd be great, because the students would come out of class and they'd, of course, look at her in her wheelchair, and they'd look up at the picture that I had her directly beneath, and they'd come over and they'd give her a hug and they'd give her a kiss, and they, you know, they just thank her, you know, for her support for the building. But she was always concerned, and I'll have to admit, David, from my staff's perspective and from the janitor's perspective and a few other things, we still accommodate lots of things, but we don't do proms anymore. there are a few things we just don't do anymore. But we do still a really broad range of things for the Missoula community.
Good. Yeah. So, you know, I know we've been using the building as a centerpiece, but I want to ask one more thing about it. You know, you mentioned this building's 10 years old, mm-hmm. relatively new. The turnover in equipment every 2 years. Mm-hmm. We've connected the School of Business to some of the larger business figures in the community. Mm-hmm. And also you mentioned this is the largest academic unit on campus and has been since you've been here.
Mm-hmm.
Why are those things true for the business, School of Business? Is it student demand? Is it the mission of the School of Business? What has driven that?
Okay.
Or either of those?
Okay. Well, David, I think you've hit on just about every salient point, but let me go back and speak to them. First of all, if you look throughout the Montana University system, even though the Board of Regents is very concerned about duplication, one thing you'll notice on every campus in the Montana University system is there'll be a business program of some sort. There is a lot of high student demand, you know, for business. And so, in terms of our relationship with alumni, and alumni giving and alumni partnerships with corporations, that's a part of what we teach them. I think we have a competitive advantage when we reach out to alumni for support, for partnerships, for those sorts of things, because it's part of how business is done. The nice thing about it is I had so many of them in classes for many, many years when I was in the faculty and full-time faculty member. And it's been long enough ago that these students now are, you know, CFO of Microsoft, or I mean, they're very well placed in organizations where we can go to them and they can really help us, you know. But a lot of it just really is it's part of the culture of business, and it's a very popular area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Dean Guyanchetta now.
Okay.
You know, you've given us your personal road to UM. How about from the classroom, the tennis court, to the dean's office? How'd that happen?
Well, that's a question I still ask myself from time to time. It was not a plan. I would like to say that early in life I knew I wanted to be a business school dean. I came here back in 75 in a tenure-track position as a faculty member, and obviously for the first 5 years, even before I got involved with the tennis team, I was very focused on teaching and publishing and the kinds of things that you need to do to sort of move yourself, you know, through the professorial ranks and get tenured. That's a very serious issue, and so I was pretty focused on that. I loved it all. I loved the classroom. I loved doing research. With my background in mathematical statistics, I had a little bit of a competitive advantage in that arena. I told you how I kind of got drawn into, getting involved with the tennis team fairly early on. I'm trying to think. It was probably not much after I started coaching the tennis team. The chair for the Department of Management was vacated. And I was approached. Who knows why you get approached for certain things, but I was approached to consider chairing the Department of Management and accepted it. I did that for 5 years, and I must say it was the most challenging job I had since I've been on the campus, because you're caught in that awkward position of being a faculty member still, because that's what you are. You're a faculty member. And yet you are administrator to some of those very faculty. And especially if you've been colleagues of theirs all along. And one of the things I've argued, and I frequently get involved for the administration, on the administration side for the union and the union contract, I've always argued it's kind of awkward to have department chairs be part of the union process. It even makes more complicated this issue of, you know, supervising your colleagues, so to speak. But I obviously must have liked it well enough and was intrigued by administration that I, when the opening for the deanship became available, I was encouraged to apply for it, and I did, and ended up being the dean. And this is my 20th year, which has got to be some kind of a record. Ted Smith was the longest serving dean before then, and he was here for 14 years. And his son Ted Jr., who's still alive, and his son Roger, I know very, very well, but they thought when their father was dean for 14 years that that would be probably a record that would, you know, stand for quite a while. But I love what I do so much still, David. You know, I'm 60 now, and everybody's, you know, well, not everybody, but more frequently than not, I get people saying, "No, are you thinking of retiring?" And you know, and I say to them, "Well, geez, maybe I should be." Because I say, "Maybe I should be." Everybody's asking me that question, but you know, I still like very much what I do, and it's kind of neat to be in a position for so long. Now, I'll tell you something very interesting about the deanship. When the position description was written 20 years ago, to be dean of the business school, even for dean of the business school, there was absolutely nothing in the position description about raising money or one's ability to raise money. They were concerned about your research. They were concerned about your teaching. You know, it was sort of the classic academic model. You know, it'd be interesting if, in fact, there were something about fundraising in that position description, whether that would have frightened me to the extent that I wouldn't have considered the position. Because I certainly didn't get into it because of the dimension of fundraising. Now, whether you're dean of the Honors College or dean of the College of Arts and Science or dean of the business school, probably early on in the position description, one of the first things you'll read is what is your experience and what has been your past success in fundraising. You know, it's interesting the way things have evolved, and again, I think it's largely because I was very close to a lot of my students. And about the time that fundraising got to be an important dimension for deans, you know, students were out there in organizations where when we approached them, they were pretty responsive to some of our needs. And so people probably look at you kind of weird when you say fundraising is part of the job that you enjoy. But it is. I mean, it's important to the job. One of the things when I first came to the university, the state supported a very large percentage of the overall budget for the university. Now the state gives us less than 12% of our overall budget. And part of it is the budget has grown so much, and so we need to be careful and not be too critical of the state, because in terms of funded research and grants, and certainly we've strapped a lot on the back of the student. I mean, I used to pay less for a semester to go to school than what students have to pay for a single textbook now, you know, and so things have definitely changed in terms of where the revenues come from. But yeah.
So, Dean, for 20 years, can you summarize sort of the direction you've tried to take the School of Business?
Absolutely.
And maybe give me a few of the signature events that, that point out your course in that direction?
Okay.
Or the travels along the way?
All right. Okay. Well, first and foremost, and I've said this in writing more than once, if I leave any legacy at all, and eventually I'll have to leave by my choice or theirs. I guess what I'd like it to be said is that I left a remarkable faculty in place. You know, we're real excited because I just got the 2007 edition of the Princeton Review, or the Princeton Guide. This is a guide, of course, that high school students use to consider where they might go to college. And on March 29th, I got up one morning and Betsy Cohen had an article. And the article was, once again, the University of Montana was the only university in the state of Montana who was in the Princeton Guide. And part of that is our university culture is pretty consistent with Princeton's culture. And again, that's one of the things that attracted me here. But in her article, the 2007 guide wasn't even out on March 29th. I finally got my own official copy. What they did is in her article, they talked about the Rhodes Scholars and the rich culture that you and I have visited about. But then in her article, she indicated, and I had to be close-vested until I got the book and really read it and made sure it was true, they kind of separated out three undergraduate programs of excellence. And in this order, it was English Literature with a Creative Writing Program, Business Administration, and Wildlife Biology. And that was pretty exciting for the faculty and for me, because we knew that we were growing something pretty special here. But any dean would say that and share that about, you know, any school that they were in charge of. So it's kind of nice to have something like the 2007 Princeton Guide, which is, you know, at least to some folks, the gold standard selection of schools, validate kind of what we would think we were doing with the faculty. Other signature kinds of things is I was faculty advisor to the first chapter ever formed of what's called ABLE, American Indian Business Leaders. And now they're nationally headquartered here in the School of Business. And every Tuesday night, I still meet as faculty advisor to our ABLE chapter. And again, it was the very first, and this was 12 years ago, because we just had our 12th annual leadership conference down in Scottsdale, Arizona. Now we have 60-some chapters on college and university campuses, and have a national board of directors. Dave Archambault out of Pine Ridge, McDonald out of Salish Kootenai College, Sherry Selway Black out of First Nations. This is a remarkable group of people. But for me, what's really exciting is I had previous to this spent time on Indian reservations in the state of Montana, mostly working in economic development, and saw. To use a track term, the many hurdles that people in Indian country were still confronted with. And so, you know, I'm kind of proud now to go on, you know, the annual leadership conference and see hundreds of students come and compete in business plan competitions and advertising competitions. And the ones that we've replaced, that we've placed in big organizations, you know, national organizations. I have a little fun with people because, you know, I say, well, this year I have 22 Indian students in the ABLE chapter on the University of Montana campus, and I'll say things like, now, two are in the law school, two are in pre-med, three are in computer science. I say, you know, in areas you'd expect them to be in. And of course, first of all, that's true, but secondly, I'm obviously playing a little bit with the heads of people because I was one that quickly, you know, drew too many conclusions, you know, about American Indians. And I can tell you, David, I've learned far much more from the Indian students than they've learned from me. But it's been fun to grow that. We're the only university anywhere in the world that hosts a World Trade Center. And that's a fairly long story in terms of how that came about. You know, the license is about $300,000. There were a couple of entrepreneurs in Great Falls, Montana, who purchased it, and they think Great Falls was sort of right in the middle of the state. That'd be a perfect place to do a World Trade Center. After they realized they weren't going to make it go, they came to me one morning in my office when I was in the other building, by the way, and said, you know, if this is going to work anywhere, Larry, it's going to work in Missoula at the University of Montana, and we think you're probably the person that we'd like to have, you know. Well, I was very anxious and had a lot of concerns. First thing I did, I'd been in a few World Trade Centers, you know, but not many. But I quickly went to the directory because I couldn't remember any World Trade Centers that were landlocked as Missoula, Montana. And so actually what we've done, and it's really neat now when we go to the International World Trade Center Association meetings, is ours is very unique. Because ours is all about education, and most World Trade Centers are all about real estate developments and those sorts of things. And so we've created a real unique educational model. You know, we have a great leader. That was part of the issue. I mean, even a bad idea can flourish with a great leader. And the director of our World Trade Center had done business all over the world. So he's come here and he's been very important to the process. But for our students who are interested in international business, I mean, the opportunity for them to work in the World Trade Center. But we get several students from the law school that come over and work in the World Trade Center. My faculty and staff and most anybody I encountered told me I'd be absolutely nuts. And there are some days that when it comes to funding and other issues of keeping the World Trade Center going, I kind of remember that advice and say to myself, well, geez, maybe you should have listened a little harder. But generally speaking, it has really served the students very, very well. And so when you talk about signatures, those are really, the national, having the National ABLE headquarters house in the Gallagher Business Building, and having a World Trade Center down on the second floor housed in the Gallagher Business Building. Crazy or not, they're here. Mm-hmm. And they've been here for well over a decade. Mm-hmm. I think many, many, many students on campus have benefited as a result of that. So those certainly stand out as being a little bit of a signature in that sense. But I think the thing I'm proudest of, and I'm being a little redundant here, David, is I'm just, look at all the textbooks our faculty write now, and the national reputations that they've established, and international reputations, I'll have to confess, a lot of what helped us attract them here was when they came here to interview. First of all, how could you not fall in love with Missoula, Montana? We'd bring them in here, too, and we'd talk to them a little bit about partnerships that we had with Microsoft and HP and some other kinds of things that they would do, they knew would be important for their own professional growth as faculty members. And I know that for many of them, it was very important for them to decide to come here. Other than, they had a lot of choices, and with universities whose names are probably a little more recognizable at large than this university. Now we have such a critical mass of them that it's sort of building on itself. I mean, I just have to stay out of the way mostly now. Mm-hmm. And they reach out to their colleagues and stuff. And so that is really exciting. And I think that's why, everybody's heard forever about the creative writing program on this campus. David, I have to confess with you, when I read Betsy Cohen's article and saw one of the three programs of distinction that were mentioned in this review were business administration, I was as surprised as well as elated. Mm-hmm.
It's good company.
yeah.
So you've mentioned the faculty that you're quite happy with or proud of having here. And I did, in fact, notice the textbooks when I came in, but I also noticed all the awards that are sitting in front of them.
Yeah, right.
And so I wonder if very specifically you could tell me a few of the names of the faculty that you think stand out here, and maybe a quick discussion of what a few of those awards over there are for.
Okay.
What are some of the things that this school's garnered?
Well, I guess the first one I'll do is I'll walk over here, and she just got back from Italy after having been in Switzerland. She has written the absolutely leading, the seminal textbook and book, and it's translated in languages too, so I'm bringing several copies here. Her name is Jackie Moore, the marketing of high technology products and innovations. She has a combination of a PhD from the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and then having worked for HP for 15 years, and then coming back to academia, and went to the University of Colorado, actually, to teach. I had won every research award and teaching award they had at the University of Colorado. I learned about her, and I knew I wanted to have her here, so I invited her to come here, and you know, I mean, she's just world-renowned. I mean, she's absolutely world-renowned. And she now has attracted a few colleagues, and a couple, she tells me, are more world-renowned than she is. And certainly, if you look at the editorial boards they sit on and the acknowledgments they get for their, what we call, A-level journal publications, I mean, they're just the very top level, and the editorial boards they're on. And again, you know, Jackie's been here now, I would say, and I'm guessing a little bit here for a historian, this will be horrible, but I'd say maybe 8 years or so. She's one example. There are several others that you can just pull up their website, their individual website. We have Jeff Shea, who is here in entrepreneurship. He did his undergraduate and his master's at Babson College, which is kind of the entrepreneurial guru mecca of the world, and then went on and got his PhD in Cornell. Has been acknowledged by several different professional as sort of being the leading entrepreneur teacher, you know, and for his research and those sorts of things. David Firth, and I'm just sort of now going from department to department to department. David Firth, who did his undergraduate, and he's British, and you'll pick this up really quickly. He did his undergraduate in physics at Oxford, did his master's in natural science at Oxford, went on to be a chartered accountant over in England, but more importantly worked for KPMG for 15 years in a consulting capacity, went to UCLA and got a PhD in information systems, and has come to this campus for, this will be his third year, and not only has he had many scientists here on campus in what we call the commercialization of science or tech transfer, I mean, I have several scientists who've been here and I've known for a long time, and they said that in terms of taking their science, you know, and commercializing it, that David's moved them further in, you know, a half a year than the 30 they've been here. David, I not only get letters from students who take classes from him, but I've received letters from parents of students who have taken classes from him that say that this person has changed their life. These people, David, could work, well, I know it because people try to recruit him from me on an every other month basis. And what I've done along with the state support for these people is I've had to go out and get private. You know, Jackie sits under what's called a Distinguished Faculty Fellowship. David's a faculty fellow. Jeff Shea is a faculty fellow. I have 9 of these people that, quite frankly, people try to recruit on an every other month basis. And so, part of the attraction is to work here in this environment, both on and off the campus. Another large part of the attraction now is that there are enough of them that they can interact with each other. But you and I know at the end of the day that you've got to be at least marginally competitive on salaries. The truth of the matter is they could go and make more money somewhere else. But we've certainly closed that gap You know, I'll tell you to the person, and I hope I don't get any one of them in trouble. The one primary reason that they tell me they came here is, and I know on any campus you go, they will tell you teaching is still very, very, very important. But to these faculty, to Jackie, to David, to Jeff, you know, and I got a whole string more I can give you, but I think you get the idea. Mm-hmm. To these faculty, they were at institutions where they weren't convinced that teaching was all that important. And for them personally, that was still the driver. I mean, you know, they loved spending time with students. They loved being in the classroom. And I won't go any further than that in terms of some of the things that were said to them relative to the overall missions of some of these universities. But they could come here, they could get the kind of support they felt they needed to continue. I mean, because when you're known internationally, I mean, there's other kinds of support that has to be available. They saw the opportunity to be able to continue to get that kind of support. But most importantly, they knew that teaching was still the primary reason we were all here. And that's why they wanted to be here. Mm-hmm. That's why they wanted to be here. They actually have to teach far more classes here than where they had to teach before. Mm-hmm. You know? When we say that teaching is very important at the University of Montana, I mean, you're over in history. I would consider that one of the finest departments on this campus. I have so much respect for the faculty over there in the history department. And you know how important teaching is to that group of people, you know. And so so that's really what drew them here, ultimately. I mean, they had to sacrifice something in salary. They probably had to sacrifice not being able to spend as much time on their research when you have to teach, you know, several classes every year too. But that's what they wanted. They wanted to come somewhere. When they said that we really care about teaching and it's almost first and foremost, they wanted to feel good about that statement.
So in 20 years as the dean and more years than that as faculty, it certainly can't have all been great faculty, great students, and awards. Share with me a tough decision or a tough moment you've had in that position.
Well, that's a fair question. I still have, you know, it's always a challenge. We're still confronted with limited resources, and I'm not so sure that isn't true on any campus. But I think state universities like the University of Montana, it's more real than some other campuses you can be. And you know, when you have a lot of thoroughbreds in the stable, and I think our stable is filling up with thoroughbreds, that, from a management point of view, that does create more of a management challenge, you know. But generally, you know, I think that's gone pretty darn well. You know, in my first couple of years here, we had turnover like the school had not seen for quite a while. The numbers exactly, I won't give you any names, of course, but five people. And I think for many years before that, there was that I don't think there was anything quite like that happened. I mean, so you know, there are certain you know, I work pretty hard. I think, you know, I think if you'd ask the faculty about me and my work ethic, they'd tell you probably no one works harder in this building than me. But you know, usually what's expected from people who work really hard?
More.
And for most people here, that just comes about quite naturally. You know, I'm not here to tell you that that we don't have days that issues get pretty rough. You know, I think the the toughest problem for the university, so the toughest problem that I continue to challenge as dean, and to some extent we have a slight advantage over the other people because we're able, even on the fundraising side, you know, to be able to bring in resources for faculty travel and faculty development and faculty kinds of opportunities. But that's a continual challenge. I often go in directions that, you know, I've got two or three new initiatives going on now, and I know that there are people thinking, boy, if I hadn't lost it up till now, I probably have now, you know. a World Trade Center here, I mean, and there's still probably some people who would argue it makes absolutely no sense today. I don't think anyone would argue about the national headquarters for ABLE being here. You know, there was a lot of suspicion early on of exactly what that would do and where it was going. But, you know, I think that is such a important part of what we do as educators. But I literally have, you know, two or three ideas now that I've thrown out that we're all processing that not everybody's equally comfortable with. And in fact, I know of at least one where I'd say the majority of the people would say, it's finally happened. Mm-hmm. You know, you've finally gone totally goofy on it.
So I don't want to end with a question about the tough things. Yeah. So that seems like a good place for you to finish up. I guess your vision for the future. What are one or two of those ideas that you're going to set the university in the direction of, perhaps, before you're gone?
Okay. Well, I just went down and visited with the students this morning on one of our newest initiatives. We're looking more and more and more to what we can do for non-business majors. And so we're actually building a few courses in our curriculum that we can do. I think we're going to very seriously look at minors. You know, the one particular initiative I'm talking about is one that I hope ultimately might bring people to the University of Montana almost for no other reason than this idea. It's called the Montana Business Development Initiative. And what we have is we have students, a woman from New York who is looking at doing a dance studio. We have students that really don't have any business background. But what is required to come into this Montana Business Development Initiative is that you have to have a business idea. Because one of the reasons that we haven't done a lot with minors is we're not really convinced if you just give a very few courses in business how much value that would add. And so a little twist on that, they're here all day long, you know, and they'll be here for a large part of the summer sort of developing their business idea and actually leaving with a business plan. And none of them have business backgrounds, you know, and we're already starting to attract some people, not only from our own campus. I think we got two or three from the law school. I think we got two or three from the pharmacy school. But we're starting to draw outside of the state, you know, and bring people to the campus that would really not. It's pretty unique, this whole idea of, you don't have to have a business background. Come here, and the only thing you have to have is a business idea. You'll leave with a well-written business plan. But, David, what they don't realize is in the process of this summer, they'll actually probably learn more about finance, more about accounting, more about marketing, more about some of the business fundamentals in this process than if we have them just take one accounting class. You know, and we take them through all the technical crap of, well, I guess I can call it crap, I'm not an accountant, of debits and credits and adjusting journals. And I think more often than not, they walk out of the class with whatever grade they get, just happy they're out of the class. And I'm not sure how much value we've added to them in terms of. And the real issue is, in most cases, they don't need to be confused by all that technical stuff. There are things about accounting they need to understand. There are things about finance they need to understand. But I guess I'm convinced that you can add a lot more value to them if you do it through the process of their own business idea and teach them these different content areas in a way that they're going to just be by their nature very interested. All of a sudden, finance becomes pretty important if you're going to figure out a way to finance a business idea. And so that's one of them. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate your time today, Dean Gancetta. Yeah. If you have any closing words, feel free to offer them.
Well, I appreciate, David, that you are trying to capture some of the history, as you call it, oral history, of the university. I do really feel like this is a very special place. I feel very, very fortunate to have spent 32 years here. And I think there's a lot of wonderful stories to be told. So thank you for taking the time and making the effort to do this.
All right.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.